Session number 801, Sydney Quinn, Reel 1.
Hello. My name is Sydney Quinn. I was born on the 1st of November 1909 in Lisburn, County Antrim. I came from a... I was born into a Roman Catholic family, a family of 14, incidentally, and I was a 13th child. In 1917, owing to the lack of work in Northern Ireland, my father had to go to Glasgow and seek employment there. He was a first-class plasterer. He got employment there, but in the meantime, my mother died and left at least 10 orphans. Well, the war was raging in Europe, and we had a pretty hard time. I was 9 years of age, and it was barefoot days, without a doubt. My young brother died in 1922 with consumption, and before that, half the family were wiped out with the same disease. Well, I was born in that working class area. I was into that working class area in my youth, and I was brought into contact with socialism through my oldest brother, Joseph, who enlisted at 15 for the First World War. And in the period of that service, he met many different fellows, and they introduced him to socialism, especially the Bobleys, the IWWs of America. And when he came home, shattered by his experience, like most of the men, all he could do was talk about this socialism, and it rubbed off on the rest of us. The brother who was next to me in age, who was older than me, Jack, he became a well-known propagandist for the Communist Party in Scotland. Well, all this was building up and making impressions upon me. But I didn't have to be told, because I think with a modicum of intelligence, you know, when we were being conned. And I decided that we're working class had been conned all the years. So the first thing I did, I fell out with religion. And by the age of 13, I'd come to the conclusion that it wasn't for me. But I was never one of those people to say, you, the other fellow, don't you have religion? Well, you can have it, all right, son. But it wasn't for me anyway. Well, I got a job as a grocer's boy after school. So I left at 14. Done most of my serious reading before I was 20. By this time I was a confirmed communist. I've never altered my beliefs or opinions. 1931, I was knocked idle, but the poor old grocer, he couldn't keep me any longer. I was working for a pittance anyway. So in 1931, came up as idle, hunger marched to London. Well, I'd done that and met the usual opposition from the police, who, to my opinion, are the first lines of defence for the capitalist system, and as such should be treated as such. Oppose them in every way. Well, we'd done the march to London under Harry McShane, whom I have a great admiration for, and Big Peter. Big Peter has always been Big Peter. A bit autocratic, in his young days anyway. Keen disciplinarian, but was just to the good. I joined the forces after I come back from London Hunger March. I joined the Royal Artillery. By 1935, I think it was, I was stationed in Lough Swilly, Buncrana, just outside of Londonderry. I was in Donegal, of course. And one of our jobs was to send a detachment of troops to Belfast because the religious riots had broken out again. That was as long ago as that. We didn't take too much part of it because it was one-sided anyway, but it was more or less a psychological weapon the authorities were using, putting the troops out in the streets. I think we lasted about a week there. And back, And this, during that year, 1935, I think it was, Mussolini invaded Abyssinia. Now, some of us were immediately shipped to Aden to reinforce that. Digression too much?
This is perfect.
Okay. Well, in my period in Aden, which incidentally, I enjoyed my life in the British Army, but I never severed my contacts or connections with the Communist Party. I kept corresponding, sending a few bobs to the League Against Imperialism, and a Gary strike came up. A Gary was a taxi driver in Aden, and they're calling for not volunteers, but fellas to go down and help the civil authorities. Well, I opposed this vehemently. I didn't think it was our job. My own whole instinct told me it wasn't our job. That's some opposition from some of the fellas, but it was settled eventually. The guys lost. But in the meantime, I was one of the few men to take measles at my age. They spotted a routine inspection, and I was shipped up to the hospital on top. I had a visit from an officer after about a week or so, just convalescing. He says, what's this you've been doing, Connie? He goes, him and I got on very well, really nice fella. His father was a Labour MP, I believe his name was Rouse. He says, you have to go home. I says, that's nice. So he couldn't get me better quick enough to get the next trooper in, and I was on it. And I didn't know at that time whether I was being sent home as medical or political, whatever it was. I had a suspicion in the back of my head it was political. And the boys in the mess decks were treating me as an invalid, you see, until suddenly the word came down that I wasn't an invalid. And I was at the muck and the rest of the boys. I didn't mind that, really. I got to Woolwich. I was taken aside and rushed through the forms and sign here, sign there. Within a half an hour, a civilian suit on and a suitcase. Right, there's your railway ticket to London, to Glasgow. So incidentally, on that train, I lost my throat and all my belongings. Right, that was 1936.
Can I stop just for a second, Sid? Why had you joined the army?
Oh yes, a lot of people ask me that. Well, when you're young, well, I consider myself young enough, and there's no prospects. I'd no ulterior motives, I can assure you that. I wasn't going to be seditious or anything. I was just going to pass it through because I knew it. I'd come out eventually. Oh no, I didn't. I was never that hardcore revolutionary. I was going to alter the world by my own efforts. Oh no. Anyway, I was back in Glasgow. I think it was the month of May, 1936. So, no jobs, back to the same ground. I re-entered the politics. I was never in great enthusiasm for party meetings or anything like that, you know. I just accepted that, you see. But I dodged meetings. I didn't like too much of meetings. I'd done demonstrations, plenty of demonstrations. Now this, Spain, it broke out. They were all wondering, how can we fight this? How can we do that? There was no way. Nothing handed down to us from anyone, because I think nobody really knew what the policy or programme was going to be. But came November, I think it was October, another hunger march. Right, on the front line for that again. And we're all saying, oh, Christ, we need to get to Spain. Well, we heard through the grapevine and different newspaper reports that there were some fellas in Spain. So Big Peter, he wasn't sure what was going to happen. And we got done what we were going to do down there anyway. I don't know if we did any good or not, but that time most of us have made up our mind. We're going to Spain sometime. Well, we come back to Glasgow. When I told my sisters I was going to Spain, well, they knew I was a stubborn bugger, so they just said, well, we will go to Spain, hope we watch it. So it was 26th of November, I think it was in Spain. The last day of November. Went to Ingram Street. Well, this isn't going to MI5, is it? And Big Peter saw us all got passports and down to London and across, and I met to George Nathan on the boat going across with some Manchester fellows. We all guessed what we were doing. But he was a man who stood out. You could see the army officer. I could see it because I was in the army. The way he spoke and the way he moved about. And he was in the fringe. I don't believe he'd been processed through King Street. I think he was doing this on his own. He more or less gravitated towards me because in the course of the passage we got to. So eventually he says, where are you going to? We're going to the trade union place in Paris, so we knew right away. But he must have convinced him that he was all right. Although there's some talk about his previous career in Ireland. Well, we don't know about that. I think he tried to clear that himself. But we got there and processed through there. And incidentally, the man who processed it, I remember him, he was a short man, real Frenchified. That poor bugger was assassinated 2 days later by the right wing, what do they call them? The Rexist? No, that's the Belgians. French fascists. Mm-hmm. He was assassinated. Got to Perpignan, and I'll always remember that because it did something to my health, which I suffered for years. A lot of the boys and myself, I think it was 2 or 3 busloads, different nationalities, going on with a North Shop dinner in Perpignan. And the wine flowed freely, let me say. And we couldn't get off the bus. Most of us were in agony. I think we were 14 hours in that bus. And we got to the frontier. We sat there another 4 hours. To all get Spanish names and Spanish passports. The usual routine. Well, we overcame that obstacle, and the next place we could was Figueres. And I always remember it. And I suppose the brigaders who went at the same time as me will always remember this. It was a big monastery, I think it was, at one time. It was the excrement. It was lying dotted all around the place. Thousands of men using it, and no proper lavatory facilities. And it stunk to high heaven. And we got our first taste of Spanish cooking. You're on beans and peas and hard, but no meat. We were fit, I'll tell you, but anything. Eventually we got to Albacete, and that was the next thing we met. This place, it was built for about 400 Spanish cavalrymen and 4,000 troops descended upon it, and it was the same chaos. Lavatories, you had to walk a mile long before you done anything. But as some of the later comrades say that the Germans got into it and cleaned it up, which was a good thing. But that was that anyway, and so we're sent out to Madrigueras to do a bit of basic training, which counted just for forming threes. This is the new thing come up, forming threes. We used to form fours in the army. This is forming threes. The continental thing. I was instructed by a sergeant, Sloan. I thought he was a Jewish fellow myself. And that was his job, to just to knock us into shape. He was an ex-regular army sergeant. Well, we did that. I think it was about maybe 40 or 50 of us. Quite a detachment from Manchester, including Martin Levine, whom I recently met again. They're all pretty raw. I was raw myself because it was a known thing going to war. Definitely going to the soldiers, but going to war, you don't know. But the word came, right, get your gear, what we had. Actually, half us went into the action, dressed as we were. Which added to from what I read, was you'd be shot as a spy if you were captured. Because we were no regalia, no thing. On the train, and Ralph Fox, to drop a few names, he was a political commissar. And I always remember he was dressed in a black leather coat, down to about there, the thigh, and his revolver at his side, and his big blackberry, very sincere. And young John Cornford, he came with us. He was a real romantic type. 6 feet tall, about 20 years of age, and he looked like a bloody Greek god. He'd been at a university city with Jock Cunningham, who was with us as well. We go down to where we got off the train anyway. I don't know the term for that, detraining or something. And we mustered along this lane, and Nathan more or less assumed command because it was his right as an officer. And he told us to march on the sides of the road for aviation, Avion we called it. We were spotted. And that fella played drugs and drinks with us, it was sitting up in the sky. Well, that we got our first casualty there. I'm not going to say the fellow was lying beside me, but I'm sure he was bloody close to me. When he zoomed away, we moved away, and this poor bugger's lying there. I'm not kidding you, that bullet that struck him, we really looked at him, I tore a hole in the size of a big football. And that was that. So we go down this road and we're moving towards this, I think it was Nathan says, this is Lopera. We're going to stop the, it starts a bit of a, I think the boys are in there, they run away. I think that was the most of it, the Spanish boys. We go down there anyway. But on the way we stopped at a grain warehouse, or beans, well, I don't know what this is. But they eat in Spain. I'd no memory for these things. But it was sacks of them. It was bitterly cold that night. But anyway, they got some ammunition up. And by dint of me being the only regular soldier in the outfit, I got most of the ammunition to carry. I reckon I had about 600 rounds of ammunition strung around my neck to move up to the taking off part. Well, the weight of the thing and carrying your rifle, and on top of that, no sleep, we're all pretty boot up. We get near the scene, we were starting to get artillery. And Ralph Fox comes running back to me because I'm struggling with this weight. He said, come on. And I said, oh, look at the weight of this. I was like a camel. So we're going moving up, and we're getting closer and closer. I just turned round. We're coming under small arms fire. I turned round and Ralph Fox had disappeared from sight. I could just see his toes sticking up behind me. But the rule of war is you don't go in back and help a comrade. You go forward. And they leave the stitcher parties. Stitcher better pick him up. I don't know where they get the story that they got to Fox's body and taking papers. I don't know. I don't know about that. But that was that, and we got to this place, and Kit Conway, I think he's been mentioned, Kit wore his regulation IRA leggings, quite an attractive little figure he was. He's dashing about, running hither and thither, yes boys, stay there now. And to my mind, he just was like the rest of us, he knew nothing about it. But his heart was good, and his courage was good. But the man that stood his most dead was Jock Cunningham, before Nathan really put on the big act. And Jock was like myself, he'd the old Glasgow bonnet on, and Jager, no uniform. And he said, all right, comrades, just take it, just keep your head down the now. Typical Jock. But I noticed myself, I'm a pretty keen observer, and there's pretty mostly all my days. I don't see my bad faults, but I see them in others. But one or two fellows who had been in the First World War, and I noticed they'd taken violent trembling. They knew, you see, they'd been through it before. But everybody suffers the same way going into the action. It was the first or the 51st time. But once you're in, everything just flows back to you. Right. Well, I'll not mention this comrade's name because he's dead and gone now. But he was really putting maybe a bit of panic amongst the rest of the boys because the fire was really terrific. You couldn't lift your head, but we were no use lying behind a hill. We're coming out to bloody well fight them. So Nathan just stood up. Now he says, you take position. He's walking along the crest of this little hill. And he had his walking stick out. I remember now, it was etched in my mind. And he's directing fire. There. And the whole situation changed. Now, we took quite a number of casualties there, but we managed to hold them. Even though we were looking down in that village street There were Moors and Italians mixed, I believe. There must have at least 100 enemy troops lying in that street, because at that vantage, we had the vantage there. We were on top of them. Then they brought the artillery and they more or less snaked us out of it, or smoked us out, definitely moved us anyway. So to come to another bit of the front to take up more positions. But by this time we'd heard that some of the rest of the 12th, the Franco-Belge, had broken on the left. But we held firm anyway, most of us, for that night. And Marshal Levine and I were left together until we were told to, it's no use just saying, we'll leave a picket up there. Well, we survived that night, and after, of course, we dug holes for ourselves to do that. See, we're going back 40 years, it's difficult to remember it all. But we did what we could, and we stopped that. They were just going to flood through the southern Spain. We'd even ideas of going on to Cordoba, but something told us we wouldn't manage it. But the next morning, early dawn, Nathan came to me. He was with this commander, I don't know who he was, Russian or Czech or something. I have a poor memory for her names. He says, I want you to go down, take Morris Levine with you. And says, a lot of our boys are down in that village there, down behind the lines. He says, don't threaten them. He says, just ask them to come back. So Morris and I went down, and we saw the fellas. Well, it's understandable. They'd run. You could just don't face a wall of fire, untrained, unseasoned. Although other troops have had to do it, we know that. We appreciate that. So Morris and I talked them into coming back. Now, for the sake of the life of me, I don't remember how long we were on that front, but the word was that John Cornford had been killed. And that was a tragic loss. But against the Cornfords and the Foxes, there were many other fine fellows lost their lives there in the first action. Now, I want to decry the Foxes and the Cornfords a wee bit of glory, such as it was. Well, we more or less left that position stable and understand that they brought rather more seasoned Spanish troops in to hold it. There's I don't remember.
This was Cravana still?
It's Lopera.
Lopera.
Now the word, I think we were there about maybe 10 days. The word was, pack up, we're moving. The fascists have broken through it. Oh, Morris, where are you? Las Rosas de Madrid. So we were shipped up there in a hurry, and that was the first time we'd seen women in action. And the Spanish women went out with their husbands to defend this line. For a change, we were a wee bit higher than them, which wasn't too bad. Well, we plugged a block in that, but before I go any further, I must remember one instance, and it was a wee bit funny from our point of view. Because behind it all, there's a lot of humour left in men, even in the direst circumstances. For instance, to go back further again, in the heat of that battle at Lopera, I'll never forget this fellow, he's an English cockney. We're lying there and we're getting machine gun from Arsenal to breakfast time. He turns to me and says, hey, what do you think of Arsenal's chances on Saturday? And I says, never in your life, Chelsea will murder them. Well, we got kind of a rapport with each other because there's no use greeting about it. So we did well. But we're coming up this road anyway, and this, I think it was the same fella. You know, the Spaniards, they use the poor wee donkeys for everything. And I see this big, great, big fat peasant riding on this wee donkey. And it's going up this hill, and we're going by in the camions, we call them camions. And this fella couldn't stand, he just stuck his foot by the old fat Spaniard down the wee hill. He began cursing him, and the poor old donkey turned up in his arse, you know. But these little things, but a few in Canal it was, we stopped, and we had white bread for the first time in about a month. And it was the most delicious meal any of us had ever eaten, because we've been living on hard tack and the lot. But we enjoyed that white bread. We don't know how they got it. And bottles of, I think, gaseous, as they called it, lemonade or something. And we appreciated that. We stopped for a couple of hours there. That was on our way up. But up there, with a few casualties, because it was a very big front. It wasn't like L'Opera. It was a huge thing, a huge canvas of fire. We were there, and I think that's where we got first we got kitted out. We were taken out of the line, along with the rest of the Franco-Belge. We were taken out of the line, and we all got new uniforms. They weren't great, but I got the best pair of boots I've ever had in my life. I think they came from the French military. They were light. And we studs in the soles, and they felt like feather with a beautiful after this stuff. I've run about in all civvy shoes. But there were one or two characters there, and especially from the L'Opera front, there was a young fellow there, a great attachment to John, and in brackets, Yank Palsiard. He's one of those Yorkshire names, I believe it is. But he's done his company runner, and he'd done it. He'd done it that well, his feet were bleeding. Running from pillars all through fire too. And giving us a laugh and a joke. You had to do that, you had to do this, and Lathan was laying it out. But he was a great character. Well, we got to there, we were kitted out. And I always remember, somewhere or other I managed to get beautiful silk shirts. Took them from my Glasgow. I think my brother-in-law or somebody had given them. And the lice are the size of your fingernails. So that was a mass burning, the new stuff to come up. But unfortunately, we couldn't get washing. There was no water facilities. So we just transferred the lice from one set of clothing to the next. But we had a great time burning those lice, I tell you. And the word was that we're going back to join a new British battalion, because the Madrigueras had been filling up with some of the boys. Well, that was all right. Eventually we got to Madrigueras and we got the hero's welcome. I think it's been well documented in a lot of books. I don't think there was many of us left. Morris asked me how many there was, and I think we went down to about 160, but I'm convinced we didn't come back more than 40. Anyway, we come down there, back to Madrigueras, and I met some old Scottish comrades, and they were very pleased to see me, and I was pleased to see them. And I got the job of town policeman. And another, a young fellow and I fell out, but I think he's never gone. I'll not mention his name, but eventually we had to lock him up because he was made of a bit of a nuisance himself. After we'd dealt with him, let him out the next day, he got up on top of a roof and threw himself off the roof, so that was the end of him. We had one or two fellows just lost all.
What was his problem?
Well, I don't know what his purpose was, but as I say, I don't want to mention names because it might create a wee bit of hurt to some of the relations. But his purpose was that he said that if he had his way, we'd never run away, you see. Oh, he had plenty of courage, no doubt about it, but he wasn't a soldier, if you understand me. You just can't fight a war on your own. So he was against all the ones that were more or less an authority, and he kind of singled me out because I had the job of knocking him, you see. But that was by the by. So we come back, we cleaned up Madrigueras. Physically, we cleaned it up and got the new cookhouse going. And about another month, I think it was, before we really got settled down, I think we had about 600 or 700 men. Then the word came to move up. We're going to some place called Harama. We called it Jarama. We didn't. Well, Nathan came to me. He says, you're going to the special guard. You and about a dozen others. I said, sure, fair enough. You just do what you're told. So we went about a regimental guard. Somebody's got to do the job. And the rest of the boys, a number were wondering, number one company went out the first day, and they were pretty badly cut up. We could hear it, but couldn't do much about it. But the losses became so bad, they just had to scrap the regimental guard and put everybody in, you see. I think it was about 3 days after the battle. Well, we're all up there, and the boys were pretty shook up. That's where young Palsiard got killed. He was one of the young fellows, dead and no fear. a fellow and him named Bulger and him decided to go on the train, go over the top and see if they'd take a fascist in or something. Well, they both killed stone dead the first minute. The snipers just picked them off. I thought it was a shame. And this man Bulger was, from what I know, he was an ex-naval officer one time, but he was still a brave man. See, but you can't win wars with bravery alone. You've got to have discipline and all the rest of it. And we'd lost the commanders, Wintringham and one or two others, and Joke, he took it over. No, he was in it. I think he took it over. Nathan had been pointed, jumped, kicked upstairs, and he was directing operations.